Please be seated, everyone,
including my colleague. This is the time and place set for argument in Burkett versus Baker, case number 72372. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please let the clerk know how much time, if any, you want to reserve for rebuttal.
5 minutes, please. Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Hillary Walsh, and I represent appellate Joel Burkett. Mr. Burkett is an inmate at Ely State Prison. For the past 16 years, he has been in solitary confinement there. Mr. Burkett argued to the district court that this violates the Eighth Amendment. The district court dismissed the mandamus petition, not by ruling on the Eighth Amendment claim, but instead on a procedural due process claim that was not raised. Now, because the court has no Eighth Amendment ruling to review, the remedy here is very simple, especially compared to the last case. We need a remand. The district court didn't make a finding of fact, didn't make a conclusion of law, and did not even review the claim that was raised, an Eighth Amendment claim. We ask that the court also instruct in its remand order that the district court hold an evidentiary hearing so these things can be done.
Ms. Walsh, wouldn't the settlement agreement be a legal question that we could look at ourselves de novo if that resolved these issues? What's your position on that?
Well, there's a couple of things. First, if the court wants to look at this as a legal issue, the concern is that the district court determined that the settlement agreement barred the constitutional claim, but it was looking at a constitutional claim that was not before it. It was looking at a procedural due process constitutional claim. Now, we need the district court to determine, or if this court wants to, then we need the court to determine whether the Eighth Amendment claim is within the settlement agreement. And for that to happen, we need things like, when did the Eighth Amendment claim accrue? The parties dispute this. Respondent says that it was in 2014 and is squarely within the settlement agreement. My client contends that it was in 2016 when he had been in confinement, solitary confinement, for 15 years. Mm-hmm. That's a mixed question of fact and law that the district court has to engage in. Additionally, we have questions about whether there could be a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of a constitutional right. That also is a question that the district court has to decide. So we just, every time we unpack it, we're going to get back to one conclusion only, and that's a remand. The question of whether there is a plain, speedy, and adequate remedy, the kind of the second part of the mandamus standard. The district court didn't make a finding on this. Respondent's brief wholly mischaracterizes the district court's decision on this point. In any event, this is a discretionary finding that the district court has to make in the first instance. And the court didn't do so here. Not only did the court, under the first standard, whether there's a clear right to the relief requested, didn't analyze the right claim, the court didn't.
Notwithstanding that fact, Ms. Walsh, why wouldn't this court look at the underlying claim, it was a written claim, but conclude that there was an alternative remedy of law and it would have been a contract action or an Eighth Amendment or 1483 action? I mean, raising the issues Mr. Burkett raised in the context of a writ of mandamus, this court really hasn't sanctioned that.
Well, Your Honor, there are a couple of Supreme Court cases, this court's decisions, that are really on point here, and they effectively create an exception to the, is there an adequate remedy? So when the court finds that there perhaps is an adequate remedy, the court can still, and this would be the district court in its discretion, can still determine, and I'll quote it so I don't mess it up, that even if the district court finds there's an adequate remedy, it still has the discretion to entertain a petition when the circumstances are urgent and strongly necessary. In that case is Hawkins versus 8th Judicial District Court. That's a 2017 decision, requoting a case from 2002. We have a lot of urgency here. The evidence about solitary confinement shows that even after 10 days, the brain begins to be altered when you're in solitary confinement. So when we already have 16 years of this consistently, this is not unbroken time, the urgency is here. Additional evidence in the record.
I want to be clear on what you're arguing. Are you saying that Mr. Burkett is allowed to recover damages for the period of confinement up to the settlement agreement, that he, if it's enforceable, waived.
I'm sorry, Judge. Can you, Your Honor, can you repeat that? I'm not following.
Yeah.
Because we're not arguing about damages. We're just asking for, at this point, just for an evidentiary hearing. So I'm not tracking. I apologize.
An evidentiary hearing leads to a claim for damages, right?
I don't know, Your Honor. I think that the relief requested is simply that he be transferred to a different prison so that he is not in solitary confinement anymore. I don't think that money damages are, I haven't reviewed that portion of the complaint. I can, during...
There isn't a complaint. There's a writ.
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct. Within the writ. Sure.
And the relief sought in the district court writ was transfer me.
It was to be released, either be the court to order his release from solitary confinement or for respondent to come forward at a specific date set by the court and say why he shouldn't be. So my client's pro se way of saying I want a hearing.
So to your point, the stacking of the time, which was a concern by the respondents under the effect of the release agreement, wouldn't be germane. He'd be focused on what happened to his segregation after the release agreement had been signed.
Well, whether there's a release and whether that settlement agreement applies to the 14 years, 13 years of his confinement, or if it only applies from 2014 to 2016 when this writ was brought, even 2 years could be an arguable Eighth Amendment violation. And so,
well, except there is some jurisprudence that talks about the effect of that period of time, and at least the cases that I've seen are much longer than 2 years. We're talking about 23 years.
Yes,
in those,
Your Honor,
instances. Do you have any cases that recognizes confinement issues under 2 years?
Not offhand, I don't, Your Honor, but the reality is, just to kind of refocus on whether the settlement agreement applies in the first instance. And the district court didn't engage in it.
Well, let's assume for the moment that the settlement agreement doesn't apply to whatever facts give rise to either his segregation or essentially segregation, if that's the scope of what the writ sought. I'm not clear, and I appreciate you weren't involved in the district court proceedings, but it's a little bit unclear as to the relief he sought to me. Was he trying to get out of segregation, or was he trying to get some other relief associated with the length, his 15 years? He makes a point of that, but I'm not sure what the relief was he was trying to focus on. So if the settlement agreement is enforceable, then it seems to me we need to address the scope of the writ and the relief sought for the period of time after the release.
These are all findings that the district court has to make, specifically because where we are at this stage is the district court didn't engage in any Eighth Amendment analysis. The district court looked at this as if it were a procedural due process claim and found that it barred, and this was an error, that settlement agreement barred the procedural due process claim. But whether Mr. Burkett specifically, whether he knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waived the constitutional right to
You don't think the language in the settlement agreement applied to Eighth Amendment claims?
No, Your Honor. Specifically because my client, sorry to interrupt you.
That's all right.
Specifically because the client during the proceedings says things like, what I agreed to in this agreement was to release them from further suit and that's it. Now, respondent bears the burden of proving that he voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently waived this constitutional right, and in its pleadings did not do so. In its answering brief, it did not do so, and so it's waived its right to do so now.
Well, I want to stick with the question. Maybe I asked it poorly. Probably did. Why doesn't the release agreement extend to an Eighth Amendment claim, which is a constitutionally based claim?
Because
the language of the, so the defense or your response is, it's because he didn't understand the agreement?
He did not know that it would, not only bar him from raising an Eighth Amendment claim based on the time that he's been, those 14 years, but also any future claims to unconstitutional confinement.
Okay.
Thank you. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Justice Pickering. May it please the court. My name is Randy Gilmer. I'm here on behalf of Warden Renee Baker in this case. And I'd like to start off, Justice Hardesty, in response to a question you asked to her, and point out that this court has ruled on this issue, and I must apologize. I cited this case in my opinion, or in the brief, but indicated that it was unpublished, and I was incorrect in that. It is actually a published opinion, so I apologize for that use of that error word. But it was Tomeo versus State. It's 126 Nev 761. It was decided December 10, 2010. Justice Gibbons, you were on that panel. And it was an order of affirmance, and I quote, "A writ of mandamus will not lie on the instant case because appellant has an adequate remedy in the ordinary course of law." Appellants, and cite NRS 34.170, continuing the quote, "Appellant's challenge to displacement and disciplinary segregation may be raised in a civil rights petition. Therefore, we affirm the order of the district court." And this is precisely what we argue here. Taking aside for a minute the settlement agreement and whether or not that barred this claim and whether or not there was a knowing waiver or violation, what we have here is a 1983 action. He's alleging Eighth Amendment violation. He's alleging conditions of confinement. This is a textbook 1983 case that was brought by Mr. Burkett. And plaintiffs, and to the extent that Mr. Burkett is arguing that the district court didn't realize it was an Eighth Amendment claim and argued it some other way, on page 3, which is at the record, Joint Appendix 140, page 3 of the district court's opinion says, "Petitioner argues that he is entitled to an alternative writ of mandamus because his prior settlement agreement prevents him from filing any other type of actions to address the alleged violation of his Eighth Amendment claims." The court was clear as to what he was seeking in the petition for mandamus. The court is also, and then went on to point out, for three specific reasons why the petition, in their discretion, in an abuse of discretion standard, should not be considered by the district court. And those three reasons were that there was no clear legal right to relief, that there was no arbitrary or capricious behavior shown, and that it was barred by the settlement agreement. And with regard to the arbitrary and capricious behavior, I had not seen anything in the briefing of plaintiff that indicated that Warden Baker reacted in an arbitrary or capricious manner here. What the record indicates is that Mr. Burkett has had his appropriate and pursuant to the administrative regulations and operating procedures, all the appropriate review hearings that he's supposed to have regarding his segregation. Many times he refuses to participate in that, but that doesn't mean that they still don't go through the process. It also points out that his determination to be in segregation is made by a classification committee. It is not something that the warden can do on their own. It's not something that the warden does on their own. There's no indication that Warden Baker did anything other than what the classification committee recommended for Mr. Burkett, and that's clear in the record based upon the declaration that Warden Baker provided. With regard to the no clear legal right to relief, whether or not to put an inmate or a prisoner in segregation is not something that is taken lightly by the institution, by the Department of Corrections, or any prison. But it is a discretionary determination of the prison to determine whether or not those things are necessary. This is not a situation where Mr. Burkett can come forth and say that Warden Baker is not doing a clear legal duty that she has. This is a discretionary determination of the prison to determine whether or not he should be placed in segregation. And that is yet another reason why the district court was correct when it ruled that that the mandamus petition should be denied. The district court
didn't mention by the district court, but is there a judicial review process available to segregation determinations made by the Department of Corrections?
There is an appeal process, and I'm not sure this is in the record, Your Honor, but there is, like any like all conditions of confinement or issues pertaining to prison, Mr. Burkett can file grievances. He can also appeal decisions. And then he can also seek a 1983 relief should, to the extent that he believes that the Department of Corrections was made an error. So the answer to that is certainly yes. He can always bring
such a question. Why would the settlement agreement govern his segregation status after the date of the settlement agreement?
Certainly, Your Honor. Thank you. And that was raising my next point. I was just getting into the settlement agreement. And again, this is the third alternative basis why the district court said the mandamus was barred. But the settlement agreement makes clear that it bars all causes of actions that could have been brought. Mr. Burkett hasn't alleged any change of circumstance from the time he signed the settlement agreement to now, or at the time that he filed the petition, that would suggest that something happened from the day he signed the settlement agreement forward that made this Eighth Amendment violation occur. In fact, the exact opposite. He's claiming that he's been in segregation so long that his Eighth Amendment violation, that he has an Eighth Amendment violation. That's clearly something he was aware of or should have been aware of.
Why wouldn't the propriety of his segregation status from and after the settlement agreement be something that he could contest?
You're
saying that this agreement would preclude him from bringing a claim, I get the procedural problem that we're involved in, but would preclude him from bringing a claim that challenges his segregation status when those determinations are being made by the committee after the settlement agreement?
Not at all. To the extent that he's alleging that he is being held in segregation.
Well, this was a pro per. I mean, yes, he does refer to 15 years, and he's tacking on all these other years and so forth. And maybe he has a right to do that. Maybe he doesn't under the settlement agreement. But I don't see how the settlement agreement precludes him from talking about improper segregation status if that happened after the agreement.
Thank you, Your Honor. And yes, he was certainly improper below. However, I would submit that looking at the brief that was filed in this court, that they're still making the argument that it's based upon the 15-year status and that he's been in there so long, and that's why the mandamus relief was necessary. Not that there was a change of circumstance from the time the settlement agreement was signed moving forward. Certainly, I would concede to this court.
Well, counsel for Mr. Burkett today argues that improper segregation, even for a week, even for a day, is improper. I think there's that was the urgency of seeking equitable relief or writ relief that would move him from that category.
Well, Your Honor, that certainly could be the case. 2 points to that. First off, this case would still fall under the Prison Litigation Reform Act and would have to seek grievances at the level, first off. I'd also like to point out, as the district court noted, and that there is no indication of current psychological harm, and that was also referenced by plaintiff in the brief, I believe in a footnote at page 4. The brief indicated, page 31, note 2, I apologize, that the psychological harm is not known at this point due to there being, quote, no psychological evaluation in the record, period, end quote. So to your point, Justice Hardesty, to the extent that this is an emergency, and causing...
It's not period, end quote. It's actual harm is not what the standard requires. It requires a risk of harm. So in fairness to your friend on the opposite side of the aisle, she's making exactly the opposite point.
Justice Pickering, yes, here, and I apologize. I wasn't trying to be curt and point out that that is the absolute correct standard, but I was using the quote here to just reference, and that was the end of the sentence. But... to point to Justice Hardesty's point was that if this was an emergency and urgency needed to be necessary, then it was important that that be provided to the district court. There is nothing like that. Even to this point, there has not been any indication in the record that that was done. So I think that the reality is we have precedent from this court that says that mandamus relief is not proper when you have an appropriate civil rights claim that can be brought in 1983 action.
And your point is that is subject to Prison Litigation Reform Act prerequisites, correct?
That is correct.
And her point is that mandamus would be appropriate because he's confined in state prison and it's a state law-based claim with an Eighth Amendment vehicle.
Well, but to the extent, and that's where I think, I mean, procedurally it does get a little complicated, but by bringing in the Eighth Amendment vehicle, I think at that point in time, the PLRA attaches and is triggered. Because you can't look at the Eighth Amendment issue unless you give the proper deference to the prisons that the grievance procedure and AR 740 and all of that was set up by Congress when in creating the right was there to do. But let's also change the fact here. We're looking at mandamus relief, and in the brief, it's conceded, plaintiff has also conceded in the brief at page 32, this could have been challenged, he could have challenged the conditions of confinement through a 42 U.S.C. 1983 action. That's been conceded. The only defense to that was it wasn't mentioned by the district court or it wasn't raised by us below. But that doesn't change the legal certainty of that fact or the concession that was made. And the district court did point out the proper standard of the law, citing NUM, which indicates there has to be a clear legal duty and no plain, speedy, or adequate remedy of law. So it was implicitly addressed by the district court.
But both the state and the district court, neither one said anything about 1983, right?
Neither one said anything specifically about 1983 in response to the petition. However, the response to the petition filed by the state provided the court with copies of the settlement agreement as well as the report and recommendation that was issued by Magistrate Judge Cobb in one of those two cases, and it was clear that both of those cases were 1983 claims. And it's also, I would think, at this point, pretty clear to judges and people who litigate in this area that when you bring a constitutional action, those are brought under 1983. So the fact that it wasn't specifically stated in the text of either the court's opinion or the respondent's opposition to the petition doesn't take it out of the fact that that couldn't apply. And also...
Right, but that wasn't raised at all in district court. I mean, that's a bit troubling to me.
I'm sorry, Justice Kerr.
The 1983 issue was not raised in district court other than referentially to the antecedent settlement case. So you're asking us to affirm a dismissal on a basis that wasn't raised?
Well, I think that you can affirm the dismissal on the issues that were specifically raised and addressed by the district court. I think this is yet another alternative reason why you can raise the alternative. So moving on to the settlement agreement itself, I think that it bars it because, again, it talks about all causes of actions that could or could have been brought. I think it's clear that this could have been brought. He had brought a 14th Amendment claim in the context of those other issues. With regard to the plain, adequate, and speedy issue of law, I'd like to also point out to the court, and I apologize for the late notice, and I'm not sure if you were able to see it, but I did submit a notice on Friday in response to a complaint that Mr. Burkett filed. Whether or not the facts in that complaint are true or not true, it's true, and I also filed another one today because based upon that, it made me think maybe he filed another lawsuit. And October 23rd, a screening order was issued. And in the screening order, the district court specifically said, this was in the filing of today, but again, I'm just asking, this is a public document, can be found in federal district court. It's case number 318-CV0022, and it's page 5, conditions of confinement. Plaintiff alleges the following facts. Plaintiff generally appears to challenge the conditions of his 15 years in isolated confinement.
Is that something that you filed with us?
I did.
Okay.
Asking that you take notice of it. Plaintiff complains that such confinement in a cell 23 hours per day without social interaction or environmental stimulation, that's the same quotation that's used in plaintiff's brief at pages 25, 27, 28, and 30 before this court, is clearly harmful. Plaintiff explains the effects of isolated confinement are well documented. And therefore the court allows his Eighth Amendment claim to proceed. This case is pending before Judge Due. So it's clear not only does he have a plain, speedy, and adequate remedy of law, he's actually taken steps to perform that to this extent. So to the extent that plaintiff has asked that this be remanded for an evidentiary hearing, I would say that that would actually slow down the process because we're already in litigation in that case right now in federal court pertaining to that specific issue. And again, and obviously we have plenty of other defenses with regard to that. I see that my time is ending, so very briefly, in addition to 1983, and I think this was raised by the district court, Your Honor, you can also bring a breach of contract action or a rescission action to the extent that there was knowing or voluntary issues. So those are other legal remedies that they have here. Thank you very much. I see my time is done. I will sit unless there's any other questions.
Thank you, sir. You have 5 minutes and 14 seconds.
The documents that counsel filed at 11:15 this morning, I've not had a chance to review. But from my brief review of them here is my client raised an Eighth Amendment failure to protect claim that the district court, the federal district court has also construed as an Eighth Amendment claim. So it's not like he's trying to litigate these things in multiple places and it looks like it stayed for 90 days hoping that the parties can reach a settlement. Other than that, I can't say much about it because I just now had a chance to look at it.
Your opponent filed two. He filed one last Friday. Did you see that one?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know how it's really relevant to what we have here, given that the district court, our district court that we're appealing from here, never made a finding about whether there was never reached that issue of whether there was an adequate, speedy remedy. So as an appellate body, to affirm on that basis because the documents that Baker is now submitting, it does not make any sense procedurally from where we are on this appeal. The court simply cannot affirm dismissal on that basis. Now, I started counting.
They submitted as requests that we take judicial notice of their existence. That determination hasn't been made.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't know if you want, I do not oppose that the court take notice of them.
Well, you'd just like to be able to say something about something you just saw.
I'm sorry? Okay. I lost count of how many times counsel talked about the process and the discretion that the warden has in placing someone in solitary confinement. That's not the issue here. And that was very distracting for the district court, and then those arguments were again raised before this court. The length of confinement is what the issue is here. And if the lower court had done any Eighth Amendment analysis and dismissed, finding there was no clear right there, we would have seen the Farmer standard, whether there was an objective and a subjective elements met. That would be my client's burden of proof, but none of that is analyzed here. It's all about procedural due process. My client asks for remand so that so that the court can analyze an Eighth Amendment claim, the only claim he raised from inside his cell with the documents and the access to justice that he had from his little law library. He was pro per. And he stated a claim. Below, no one asked for this to be moved over to federal court. All of a sudden, that is a red herring that the court should ignore here. Because the reality is they had the opportunity to do so before and they did not. The court.
Are you familiar with the 2010 case that counsel cited incorrectly as an unpublished decision?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
That was published?
In that case,
could you address that case?
Yes, Your Honor. That case says that disciplinary hearings and placement in segregation are 1983 claims. That's where those are supposed to be. That's the funnel that they're supposed to go in. But this isn't placement in, and this isn't a disciplinary hearing. The procedure and the process in getting in there, it's the length of time that we're in there that gets us into Eighth Amendment and properly before the lower court. Doesn't necessarily have to be a 1983 claim. That's not what that case held. That case is really specific to procedure. And we are really, really in substantive land here. The reality is that my client raised one claim, a substantive Eighth Amendment claim. You read the decision, the court didn't address it. The court didn't analyze it. The court talked vaguely about constitutional issues, but never analyzed the required Farmer U.S. Supreme Court precedent standard that governs an Eighth Amendment claim. We ask for remand because without any of that analysis, this court has no basis on which to affirm or deny. It simply
must
be.
But what do you say to Justice Hardesty's point that because of the settlement agreement, which was consummated, let's say, 2 years ago, that takes out 14 of the 16 years of solitary confinement and therefore diminishes the pure Eighth Amendment claim substantially?
The district court is who needs to address the legal merits of that claim.
Okay.
And whether that claim fails or not is something at this level we simply cannot ascertain. The district court has to have enter those findings of fact
and conclusions. And your point is a week is substantial for Eighth Amendment purposes?
I'm sorry, Justice.
Your point is even a week of solitary could amount to an Eighth Amendment violation?
My argument is that that Baker has the burden of proving that my client voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently waived his right to bring his constitutional claim. And that is a mixed question of fact and law that the district court did not engage in. So we have a big question mark about whether the settlement agreement actually bars this. And then we can get into when this constitutional violation accrued, which is also a question of fact and law that the district court did not entertain.
Thank you very much. I thank both counsel for their arguments in this case, and this matter will stand submitted.